the Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Joining me on the podcast right now, and of course, live in video, hot from off the tiles. He's been on the town celebrating. You can't be celebrating the stock market. But Paul Hill, here he is. And how's things, fella? Feeling good?
Yeah, I've got a bit of a sore head. Apologies first to everybody in advance. That's the first time I've got drunk for about 25 years last night. We went out for sort of like just a sort of a team do in Leicester Square. In fact, the fun thing about which sort of like strikes me about London and railway stations is you meet some very colourful characters and lots of tourists. And when we went into Chinatown, it was just totally decorated with amazing sort of, you know, places, and you had statues and you had casinos, you had people in all types of garments and different ages enjoying themselves and partying. It was just a total unknown reality for me. So thoroughly enjoyed it, and a big thanks to everybody who sorted that one out. So I wasn't celebrating the stock market. It's been a really tough sledging.
You see, it's been awful. And do you know what? I mean, just checking London there. I mean, is it busy there? Are people out celebrating? Lots of people going on? Is there a cost of living squeeze obviously going on or not?
No, not in the central London. I mean, literally, it was absolutely rammed. And you couldn't get a seat on the tube. And I mean, it was just great. It was great to see people enjoying themselves, different ages, bringing families, lots of tourists. There was lots of Japanese, not many Chinese, Spanish, you know, Europeans, lots of Brits, and it was a great day. You certainly wouldn't have thought there's a cost of living crisis, that's for sure. Albeit there clearly is hitting a number of people. I mean, we talk about it a lot in terms of the energy, and certainly one of the companies that I've been sort of following pretty closely, Cape Box, came out with a sort of unplanned profit warning this week, saying that its actual gross margins are hit by the cost of living crisis and hiring sort of like flour, freight, labour, other input costs. And also it dampened down some of the franchisee sales in its shops. Because of the, basically people cutting back. And that, you know, and that says everything, because it's a quality business, far more resilient than most consumer stocks. It's a franchise model. And it shows that people are actually cutting back even on birthdays and sort of important family celebrations. We're not talking major sort of, you know, sort of like moves. They're still going to be pretty profitable this year. They're just not going to grow or have their profit margins quite as high as they were last year. They've still got a very good, solid cash balance. The shares got on fairly sold off on the actual day. And then the following day or in the evening afterwards, the CEO, Sukh Chamdal, put in about £225,000 of his own money to buy, and that sort of helped the shares, because I mean they were just sold off indiscriminately, and I think they still are cheap, even though they've come back about, I think the last time I saw they're about 140, and I did a valuation of the stock using these new numbers from their broker Shore Capital, and I think they're worth a minimum, you know, very modest 180p to, you know, 205. And so there's still plenty of upside. And they went down they touched below a pound at one stage, which was just frankly a steal. It was a gift. It was a celebration gift.
Yeah, yeah. Well, do you know what? 2 weeks ago, I was quite bearish. And you were saying not a lot has changed. But I think we're going to see more of this. And I think it's going to last longer than we think. Because if you look at companies, and I keep saying this, you know, companies pretty much, you know, they when they report figures, there's three expectations that come out, really. Either they you know, exceed them, those expectations out in the market, they meet them, or they're below them. And if they get below, then they take a massive hit in this market, and sometimes overdone. And you can pick up some bargains, you know, if you're intending to hold over the long term. But you've got to be aware, you know, where we are at the moment. I mean, if you are like, I mean, Cake Box, excellent business, and it will do very well over the long term. But if you are like them, you are retail facing, you know, it's discretionary spend. They also manufacture, so they are quite energy intensive. Now, you've got the top line taking a hit. You've got costs going up. So, and that's not going to drop off a cliff for a while. But like I said, they are one of the companies, I mean, there are lots of companies not as good as them, don't have cash for them, not generating a profit. So it's a good business and it'll do well over the long term. But I mean, in the 6 to 12 months or so going forward, you've got to look at the companies you hold and think, you know, how is reporting by this company going to go in the next 6 to 12 months? Are they going to meet? Are they going to be below? And if they are energy intensive, if they are consumer facing, retail consumer facing, it's discretionary, it's going to be a hard time for them. I hold stocks like that, you know, but a lot of it's priced in, maybe, you don't know. But I mean, I think we are in an historic sort of, bear market recession here. And if you look at the inflation 40-year highs, I can't see this being a short dip. I think, you know, I think it's going to play out for another sort of six months, this dodgy market.
I think there's three things I'd say, you know, on that. First of all, when you look at your own stocks on consumer, just come back to your question when you said, you know, is it priced in? I don't know. Well, you need, that's for every investor, they should work out or at least get a good view of the what they think the intrinsic worth or what the valuation of the business, because that'll give you an indication of whether you want to hold it long term. Now, when it comes to sort of the short term, when you were talking about sentiment, when they go up and down on expectations and is it going to sell off, et cetera, what tends to happen with the strongest and best businesses in downturns is that they actually continue to win market share. In fact, they win market share faster as the weaker players fall out the market and actually tend to either go bust or pull back on marketing. So what you'll find for quality businesses like Cake Box, their competitive strengths, their brand will actually get stronger in a downturn. And so the intrinsic worth will go up, even though the share price might not be reflective of that. So the gap between your upside and, you know, downside, that risk reward profile will actually improve over time in a downturn, because essentially the strong get stronger in the tougher times ahead. And just to give you an indication of how good this product is, I did some more lovely due diligence on it. And this was a more secret sort of, like, you know, testing, and I have big family do only at the weekend. My daughter said I wanted the Cake Box cake, so we got the whole family round, and it was absolutely brilliant. I mean, and that is totally kosher. My mother-in-law, who's 84, took a big extra piece home because she just loved it. My dad did as well, who was 82, and some of the guests say, you know, my youngest daughter's boyfriend says he always goes for a Cake Box because he loves it, and the quality is absolutely first rate every single time. Yeah. So what I would say is that when you, just coming back to your observation, it's going to be tough sledging. Yes, it is. If you've got long, relatively medium to long term time horizons, you're not investing on margins, you don't have to sell, then just ride out the actual volatility in the short term, whatever the price does, because actually the competitive advantage, the, you know, economic moat, the actual USPs of that business, the brand, are getting stronger for the long term. So when the good times do come and the market then catches up with you in terms of understanding that the brand and the business has got better because the other competitors have fallen out, then you'll have an absolute field day. So don't get shaken out by short-term volatility. If the business you've invested in is high quality and it's growing its market share.
Yeah, but do you know, that's pretty much exactly what I said. I mean, do you know what? I came in for a bit of flack 2 weeks ago because I mentioned I've moved some stock around.
You give me enough of it.
Yeah. Well, I said, you know, have you sold it? I've moved some stock around, and, you know, some of that stock I moved was from XPF. And so people say, you've sold that.
Let's hang on.
Let me say one thing here. I've done exactly the same thing with XPF, right? I said exactly the same thing you just said there. I said, listen, you have to understand, during lockdown, COVID, right, XPF, which was then Escape Hunt, doubled their estate. They did this boom battle bar takeover. So when you have weakness in the market, good management, you know, and key players with this, take advantage of it. And I said XPF will probably come out the back of this a lot stronger because pubs are suffering. A lot of places where people can celebrate and go out and drink and do stuff, they won't be there. But people like XPF will. They'll probably increase their land estate. And I've even taken estimates down on them by 20% for this year, 15%, 10% over the next 2 years. And there's still good value at this level.
Yeah, no, I would agree.
But anyway, as I said...
Can I just add to that as well, Justin? you know, they are, I mean, I think they did a fundraise, what, about 6 to 12 months ago, something like that. So they've actually got enough money to last them through the, you know, any sort of short-term volatility. So in that respect, they are going to be in a much stronger financial position than their other, you know, their competitors who do these sort of destination, you know, sort of pubs and places that people are going to enjoy. So on that basis, with the cost of capital going up, then that adds to why you should hold that stock in the long term.
Yeah, it's like they couldn't afford to get into the premier retail, you know, shopping centres pre-COVID, and then all of a sudden, COVID happened. Loads of companies pulled out, and you know the owners of these centres were saying we need to fill these units, and so they're offering amazing deals, you know, cash up front to develop the sites and all that stuff. So this kind of thing will happen again. And by the way, you know, I did say I've moved a bit of stock around, but people take that as a binary sell. I've you know, rotated some stock. I still hold more stock in this than the CEO and chairman combined. So I'm still in it for the long term. I still believe in it. I believe in the management. I believe in the business model, but. You know, people say, "Oh, you sold some." No, I've just moved some stock around and say some of that stock went to E-Energy, like I said, because you know, long recurring contracts. They are helping businesses with the biggest problem at the moment, which is energy bills. And I see in the 6 to 12 months, I see when I talk about you know companies exceeding or meeting or below expectations, I see E-Energy exceeding. They've had two record quarters. They're busier now than they've ever been, and so it's just literally balancing the portfolio. That's all. I still hold the same. I haven't done made any trades for over a month or so.
When we chatted 2 weeks ago, I think you were 100% clear. In terms of the word you use, you trimmed or you eased on what you know a couple of stocks, and then you put them into it, rotated. And one of them you said you sort of like trimmed, and it was trimmed. It wasn't selling; it was trimming. It was XPF, which is you know your Boom Battle Bars boys. Now, just on that one, so how many what sort of like number of shares did you own, and what sort of number of shares did you sell?
And listen, right, I'm not going to go through the entire amount of shares I hold because. A little bit in my chat group, but obsessed with it. And I think the fact is, all you need to know, they take up a major part of my portfolio, top three holdings. I still hold them, you know, and I will continue. I mean, right now, it's a tough time. It's hard to know how much is priced in, but I think a lot is priced in. You know, it's like they're, what, 17 million market cap, they've got 6 million in cash. They're going to be profitable this year, and the EV is about 12 million. They're going to be doing 25 million of sales, okay, even if you trim that back, you know, to 20% drop and an EBITDA 20% drop, there's still good value. So you just got to see through this.
So who are your top three holdings or what then?
I said Truefin.
Is your biggest, is it?
No. I got Truefin, XPF, and E-Energy are top three, pretty much. I mean, you know, other ones have taken a blood knock, so they've gone down a bit, but. Yeah, but I still hold decent chunks I told my player in a while back because I should have trimmed before that FDA approval, but that's coming up again now, the resubmission for that. But I want to make sure that passes because I do think that's a globally significant technology there. But what's nuts, though, to my Truefin, I just looked on LinkedIn last night. Satargo, which, of course, is owned by Truefin, done a deal with Visa. And I thought, what? Why haven't you RNS that? So now they've got Lloyds, they've got Sage, and they've got Visa. Now, I did say, if you created this company, I don't know, 5-10 years ago, as a startup software company, and you had dream partners you know, you wanted to you know, align with, those top three there, Visa, Lloyds, and Sage, phenomenal, you know? So that's going for it. But again, that starts to monetize the Lloyds deal in Q4. On the Stargo side, but I'm quite bullish with that as well because I think, you know, as far as invoice lending is concerned, I think that'll be in demand over the next 6-12 months. If you look at when you look at the macro, have you changed your mind? Come out of Jackson Hole and the Fed talking about staying higher for longer. Have you changed your mind at all on the macro of how serious this is going to be? It came out of Jackson's Hole, I know.
Exactly. No, it was a bit of a frightener, wasn't it? I think the market was obviously hoping that there was going to be some sort of like, you know, easing of interest rates in 2023. And they got a sort of very cold dose of water thrown on them after Jackson Hole. Now it seems the Federal Reserve is going to push interest rates probably up to nearly 4% as a peak and then hold them for most of next year to continue to reduce inflation. because it's going to take some time to get pushed out the labour market in particular, and also out the housing market. And also what seems to happen is a similar sort of situation is being priced into gilts in the UK. And on that basis, it's not a surprise we've had this sell-off over the last 2 weeks, which has hit not only consumer-facing stocks, but also the housing sector. House builders are now looking, I mean, they were cheap before, now they're looking ultra-cheap. And some of the, you know, the car stocks and the tech stocks and long-duration assets. Now, coming back to my view of what, you know, it's going to be like, I mean, I'm still sort of like, you know, more of a sort of the glass is half full, because I do believe there will be at some point a ceasefire, not a peace, but a ceasefire in Ukraine-Russia war, which will no doubt help sentiment. And I think, I just cannot believe the Chinese are going to continue with their zero COVID policy, because it's crippling their economy. They're either going to get their own vaccines such that they're actually going to combat Omicron, or alternatively, they're going to have to use somebody else's, whether that's an Astra one or whether it's, you know, Pfizer or Moderna or whatever it is, because, you know, they just can't continue knocking down the second largest, you know, world economy. So I think there's some really good legs that potentially could happen. And we've already started seeing corn coming out and wheat coming out of Ukraine and Russia, and that's helping, you know, sort of food prices. As more companies lay people off and we get the unemployment rate ticks up, let's say to 4-5%, that sounds not great, and it clearly isn't. But if nothing else, it's going to sort of take some of the bubble out, the sort of the wage inflation put in there. The issue you're going to get, I hate to say it, when it come back to question, ask me at sort of like 1:30 this afternoon after the US jobs report, because good news is going to be bad news, because if actually the labor market's still pretty strong, they're adding 300,000 jobs, and wage inflation underlying core is going to be like 5% still and looks strong with expectations, then frankly, the Federal Reserve is just going to carry on raising interest rates until it breaks the economy. And the longer that positive economic labor data happens and inflation data happens, it's good news is bad news. And
a while back I was thinking this can't be as bad as the great financial crash, this recession. Now I'm starting to think it could be even worse, because I mean, with the
God, I don't like speaking to you on a phone. No, I know,
but do you know why though? So this, because there's an, you know, imminent danger that the banks, you know, obviously going through seizing up, but you know, there was immediate action the banks, the central banks could take here, and that was bail them out. And essentially, obviously, the economy took a hit. Now, with inflation, it's stickier than that. They can't, you know, it's a long game. It's a very much a long game. I mean, and I think we're seeing lots of stuff not yet playing into it. I mentioned sort of even energy prices. They're going to be high energy prices going to be around for a long time. They're not going to just come down overnight.
Why would they? If you get a ceasefire in Ukraine and Russia,
yeah,
why
but that's
would
massively,
they
that's what I said, we said last year, that's hope. Okay, let's, you know, hope for the best, but prepare for the worst. Because I said, you know, war has been going on in Ukraine since 2008, pretty much. And I can't see what would make Putin back down. You know, I can't see why he'd do that. Why would he want some kind of win there? And he's going to keep going. And overnight, it's not going to happen. I mean, you know, we can hope for a lot of stuff. But I mean, if we carry on the way we are, like, I mean, just look at the way we are at the moment, even in America.
When you say hope, you're putting a probability of what on it?
Well, I've no idea. How do you put a probability on a madman's brain? It's like
I'll put it out there. Okay, I think it's better than a 50% probability that in the next 6 to 12 months we will get a ceasefire, not peace, underlined, not peace, but ceasefire between the Russian and Ukraine crisis. If we get that, I believe that the oil price and the resultant gas price, but certainly the crude price, because that's where everybody sort of remembers, that will come down to in the region of between $60 to $70 a barrel, and you'll see Dutch gas come down from what they, you know, rather than being 10
understand.
Times.
If that happens, if the ceasefire happens, we know what will happen then. It'll be very positive. I mean, you know, all these prices will come down. But I'm saying, what are you basing that on? Because there's been more there since 2008.
Because what I'm basing it on, yeah, is Russia will dig itself into the Donbass over the winter, and there'll be essentially no, you know, the Ukrainians won't be able to get in there. The Russians will basically just defend it. And then indirectly, there will be, you know, European pressure on Zelensky with caveats and support from the West to be able to help Ukraine going forward, for actually for him to meet, to have a ceasefire with Putin. And that's what I'm basing it on, is such that it will be in Putin's interest to dig in and to just to take the Donbass. It won't be in Zelensky's interest to totally get it in terms of agreeing to that. But I think he will be sort of indirectly forced into that position by Europe just as a ceasefire, not to admit surrender, not to say he's not going to have a go at it going forward. And he might well have go forward with Western troops, or not Western troops, but Western help at all going, you know, afterwards. But because of the economic storm it's causing in Europe, I actually believe that the likes of Germany and Northern Europe and people like that will indirectly try and get a ceasefire between the two countries.
Yeah, no, listen, I'm hoping for that. Even if that happens, what happens to Gazprom then? Do you think they'll start supplying Europe again? Or will they start buying? Will even Europe start buying off of Gazprom? And because,
yeah, I do. Yeah. I do. I think, let's be clear about it. What you can't see going forward is can be a bigger opportunity than what you can see, the risk. So, yeah, that's how I look at it. I actually think by this time next year, the oil price will be between $60 to $70 a barrel. That'd be my view.
Well, I think it will be anyway, because the only way, you know, central banks, as we know, the only way they can really successfully tackle inflation is by slowing down the economy. And so I don't understand people that. That means is slowing growth, you know,
and to the point
where less
case,
demand is needed, less supply is needed. So it'll create, either way, it'll go down. I do believe, obviously, inflation will go down, but it'll take a while. It just depends. I mean, there's not going to be a secret fall off a cliff in inflation. It's not going to happen. It's never happened previously. And the only way they can bring it down as we are without this, you know, ceasefire is by, like you say, cratering the economy. Now, that comes at a huge cost to businesses around the world. People get laid off. Even right now, you know, I see it, in America, I've seen home sales are down 20%. Mortgages are at a 22-year low. They got mortgages at 6.25. That'll happen over here. I mean, you know, they get people trying to remortgage at double the rate they're at now. It's, I mean, the cost of living squeeze is coming from all angles. And so I don't see how that will not hit business. I don't see how it won't take a long time. But of course, I hope for a ceasefire there. But I think there's a lot of hope there, considering he's a warmongering maniac that, you know, wants a win there somewhere.
Which is good, because let's be clear about it. It's a two-sided market, and I'm more positive than you are. I believe in the next 12 months, there's a 50%, more than 50% chance of that happening. And so the upside benefits bigger than the actual downside risk. And I don't think there is going to be a really, really hard recession. There could be, but I don't believe there's going to be. And on that basis, I'm very much sort of along the lines of just, you know, hold my positions that I think are, you know, good value. I'm not going to be shaken out just on worries and hope that I don't actually believe.
Yeah, well, I think there will be a hard. In fact, look at the stats here, right? I've got some stats here, and this is like, just look at the S&P 500, right? 17% down in the first 167 trading days of 2020. It's the fifth worst start to year in history, all right? The 13 times the S&P was down more than 10% the first half year, it never posted a positive figure for the year. The only years greater in volatility than this was the 1930s Great Depression, the dot-com crash, 2009 global financial crash, and the COVID crash, which was largely brought on by shutting down the economy. But, and like I said, the last eight times S&P was down in the calendar year, bonds finished the year up, so cushioned the blow. 2022, stocks and bonds both down over 10%, something we've never seen, never seen. So I think this, we are at 40-year highs in inflation. I think we are at an historical, you know, point in our history, and I do think it'll be a tough recession. I really do. So unless we get
go and hide fire. Underneath your bed, then Justin.
No. I'm listen. Like I said, I'm a long-term holder. You know, I've held some of the stocks
no,
for
you
years.
You are.
Listen, this is the thing. You've got to be bullish to hold equities, but also I've got to have a bit of reality, thinking, okay, how bad could this get? You know. So I do think it's not going to be a short-term lived recession. I think it'll be a tricky one, but I think
no wise some, words, wise
some
words.
Some of it's priced in, you know. How much is priced in?
And I take it on board, no doubt about it. I think the key is that you and I don't invest on margin, and we're happy to hold. We can hold our positions through thick and thin. if you've been a distressed seller, that's when you get taken out by the knees.
Listen, my portfolio value has gone down by like around about 50% in the last 18 months anyway. So I've seen, you know, I've felt a lot of pain, maybe a bit more pain to come, but I can see
you've had a sharp haircut.
Yeah, I know. I always like to. Let's talk stocks. Regardless of that, obviously, it's a market, a stock market, a market of stocks. What are you looking at there?
Well, today we had, I don't talk about it very often, actually, Lung Life AI. They're basically a pioneer, a leader in early stage cancer diagnostics out in the States. They're developing this new lung LB test that's based on circulating tumor cells. It's really leading cutting edge science, single draw. And what effectively, it's currently going through validation tests and it will be doing utility tests. And the difference between the two is a validation test, which they're currently doing through different sites and stuff, tests or confirms the clinical and the scientific basis of the test, the actual performance, the accuracy, the specificity and the sensitivity, et cetera, the predictive performance value. And then the utility test, which they're going to do later on, afterwards, from next year, that basically in the real world tests the benefits to the actual patient. But regardless of that, that's just sort of like what it means is that essentially their test is going to help patients be diagnosed who, you know, lung cancer early stage, which could potentially save, you know, millions of people's lives, given there is 1.8 million people who die of lung cancer each year. And this is a sort of like a potential total addressable market of nearly 3 billion per year just in the US. And it could be, you know, revolutionary for it, because at the moment, the best in class test is just using like CT scans and then having to do biopsies, and it's really just to pin the tail to the donkey type thing. They don't know really what they're looking for. So this will really bring a lot of science and insight to it. And the company this morning said that it'd just been given approval by another state. It's got 46 already, but it wanted the New York state approval to do these commercial testing. And the reason why that's important is because it's one of its key shareholders and partners. It's sort of like flagship clinical testing center is in Mount Sinai in New York. What that means basically is that they've got another great endorsement of the actual technology. And, you know, they're all on track to finish the validation test, I think, if I remember rightly. I think it's quarter one next year. And then they'll get hopefully approval and medical clearance and first sort of like commercial revenues for next year. They raised money about 12 months ago on the market. And they don't need to raise any more at the moment. So, you know, they've got enough cash to be able to take them through. So I would say this is best-in-class technology that's been sold off. It's quite an illiquid stock. Yeah. But it's great technology. And if they hit it out, I mean, you just got to look at the numbers, and they're all hypothetical. But if you sort of take a, you know, if they took a 5% market share of just the US market over time, over a five-year period, and given that there's nothing else out there of this sort of like, you know, ability and well-balanced, and they're using AI on it as well, you know, you could see the shares go from about, I think they're about 130 something, 120 at the moment. I mean, I put a fair value. If they theoretically got only 5% of that US market, it would be 20 quid. I mean, it'd just be an enormous sort of home run. So, and Mount Sinai have got 10%. I mean, they clearly like the science, which means, and they've got some of the best medical brains in the world who are working on it. So they believe in it, but there's obviously risk, and we'll just wait and see. I mean, they've got to get FDA approval, and I did see your Polarian imaging is also going for FDA approval again, isn't it? The end. I mean, it really is a bit of a. I hate to use the word, but Americans love it—the crapshoot, isn't it? Regardless of whether the science is top draw, it does not mean that it gets approved by the FDA, because they get lobbied from left, right, and centres from so many different people that it isn't always effectively a meritocracy. It's who shouts loudest sometimes.
Yeah, exactly. No, I, when they first IPO'd, I interviewed the guys at Lung Life, and
Paul Pagano.
Yeah, and very impressive. Yeah, but like I said, you know, if you look at the chart there, It's a bit of a nightmare.
But everything's small cap. Actually a lot of much better performance than...
Yeah, did you see that yesterday? I mean, in fact, AIM, all the AIMs, so AIM 50, AIM 100, it's a new low yesterday from their high, down between 34% and 37% since their high in September last year. So it's fallen off a lot faster than anything else, but like it will rally faster than everything else, you know, so... Yeah, I mean, there we are.
Well, it's just one of those things. I mean, it's baby in the bathwater stuff. And another one which has been baby in the bathwater, and this has happened, I remember you talking about it sort of like 6 months ago, was Avacta. And it hit the shares came off to about sort of 50p. And you were saying, crikey, you know, what's happening here? You know, and I said, well, it's just all it is people who, you know, sort of just came on board because of the COVID testing part of the business have just been selling off indiscriminately. And the shares are about 120 now. Anyway, they came out with some great news this week that their lead precision treatment, the pro drug, Prodoxorubicin, the AVA6000, has just been given safety approval to progress to the fourth cohort of its phase one testing at a higher dosage level. And just to give people a sort of like a sense of perspective here, doxorubicin in its sort of like natural form is an extremely powerful chemotherapy. In fact, unfortunately, it's so powerful that not only it kills the cancer cells, it kills lots of other healthy cells. And that's always been its sort of biggest problem, particularly around the sort of the heart area. And so this prodrug effectively encapsulates that doxorubicin, hence the prodoxorubicin name, and just deposits the actual chemotherapy on the solid tumor in that particular area. And that's its actual sort of USP. That's the precision technology, the precision platform. And what they said this week was that they've now lifted the dosage to 200 milligrams rather than the standard for doxorubicin, which is, I think it was something like 70, something like that, milligrams. So we're talking of about three times stronger on concentration, which is brilliant because that says if the safety profile is fine for this, for the prodoxorubicin, for the prodrug format, and this is with we're thinking of really, really sick patients they're being tested on. So for the safety profile to be good and to be approved to go to that really strong dose, that says everything, that certainly on a tolerability basis, it works really well. The next stage is hopefully the efficacy will also work. So once the safety looks absolutely spot on, is it actually depositing the chemotherapy on the solid tumor to destroy the solid tumor without causing problems? And we'll only know that in the fullness of time. And there's a lot of really good data coming through, the PKF data, other readings in terms of, I think it's the biopsies data. And then the big decision at the end of phase one is what the maximum tolerated dose to be. Or this is it's a phase 1A, which then goes into phase 1B. And they'll use that maximum tolerated dose then as the dosage regime to do further tests to get assessments of continued on the safety, but also the efficacy as well. But it looks really, really positive, and a lot of very smart people are saying some very positive things about it. But clearly, who knows? As in terms of these things do take a long time. One thing which if that does come good, it will absolutely rubber stamp the platform and potentially open up the market from the doxorubicin sort of like addressable market is about $1.5 billion worldwide. But effectively, chemotherapies can be ultimately about $70 billion. So that could be an absolute and massive home run. And then they've got an equally good platform, the Affimer platform, that's doing all the diagnostics and also therapeutics, which is effectively the, it's like an antibody platform, et cetera. So that's got brilliant science as well. So it's got lots of shots on goal, still plenty of cash. And they seem to be going from strength to strength with lots of different sort of like, moving parts that are they're going in the right direction.
Yeah, yeah. In this market, you're right. You know, selling begets selling, and market makers or market down. And like I said, that was in March, went down to sort of 40 pence. And
yeah, exactly.
It shot to 146 then in April.
I know.
Do you know what? A lot of trades, I'm not a trader, but you got to be careful. The falling knife trade you see a lot of companies, you know, really getting massively oversold for a little while, and they can be even more oversold, and then bouncing nicely. I mean, if you are a trader doing that, there's some decent upside there in companies like this, you know. And I said on the webinar, I said Cakebox, you know, it's taking a big hit. I can imagine this bouncing. I mean, that's not my kind of play, but I can imagine this bouncing quickly. And well, it has, isn't it? Maybe we're down to sort of, you know, like I said, a quid, and now it's back to 145. So well, at the moment, that's the only success some people have in the market. He's fallen off a lot. But be careful, you know, it can fall further. But if you get the timing right, if your timing's good, you can get some returns there. But it's a scary market. But
the CEO bought, I mean, he obviously saw that it was just being sold off and it was just indiscriminate baby in the bathwater stuff for a high quality business. I mean, one which is really interesting, which should be on people's radar screens, and you can't trade it now anyway because the shares are temporarily suspended, is we've talked about it a lot, is Revolution Beauty. And they sort of like talked about that they probably wouldn't be able to actually get their audited final numbers for FY22 published by the drop dead date, the 31st of August. Anyway, that was the case, and therefore just by normal sort of AIM trading laws, then the shares are temporarily suspended until that happens, and they believe they'll be able to issue the final audited numbers in the next 2 or 3 weeks, hopefully sometime in September. What was quite interesting was the last 2 days, on the 30th and the 31st of August. Normally, if a share is going into sort of being suspended, you get a lot of retail who actually sell out because they're not allowed to hold unlisted stocks in their actual brokers. Actually, the shares went up, and that was really quite interesting. So people see value, and I actually suspect is that, coming back to your observation, there's too much fear priced into this, and I'm hoping that when they do release their audited numbers, the picture is a lot better than people think. There's nothing major, and you know, as in like extra, and then they effectively trade it out throughout the year. And as I said to you, I could see the shares double quite quickly if they just come out with no more bad news. It won't be good news, but no more bad news.
And well, that one day they hit seven pence and a quarter on the 11th of August, and then they rallied pretty much to 27 pence again. That was, you know, if you're a good trader, those kind of things there, be careful. Don't go too big on them to make it lower. But, I mean, you know, there's money to be held there. Okay, cool. Have you sold any, bought any recently?
Ah, yeah. Well, that was quite interesting, actually, because, this is another big theme, and this comes back to your broader perspective, your positive, your negative. Another big key theme is if you've got a quality business, particularly in technology or software or even in medicine, et cetera, it tends to get, if the shares get indiscriminately sold off, they tend to get being bought out by private equity or by a trade buyer. And you're seeing it all the time. So you had Micro Focus last week. It looked as though they had an agreed bid from Open Text. And then one of my companies likewise has got a sniff from Aviva. We've got a sniff from Schneider Electric, who own 59% of it. And they are saying by the 21st of September that they will make a decision about whether they're going to put a full offer on the table to buy it out. And the shares popped up. Now, as you know, I've owned it for, I don't know, not that long, actually, probably since March. I think I bought it when on the sound of guns over in Ukraine and Russia. Mm. But the shares, sorry to say, the company hasn't done so well. It's had a couple of profit warnings, went down to below £20. And so when they popped up to about 28 quid, where they currently are now, I sold my position in that and then wanted to redeploy. So what I've done is that I've sold Aviva, which was a sort of like a 4 or 5% position in my portfolio, and put all the money into my new stock, which is a software, a service type business, is Essensys, which is ticker ESYS. And they're effectively a digital software developer of all things for sort of commercial real estate, but mainly for flexible offices for large landlords around the world. So the customers are like sort of Cushman and Wakeman, and you've got JLL, and then you've also got the commercial offices of Blackstone as well, who are theirs. But essentially what their software does, it's got two pieces. Its biggest element is its Connect platform, that basically for all for a a sort of like a short tenanted office, say in London, for instance, they will provide all the necessary, internet access and telcos and from their private network. And so it allows then the provider, the landlord, to provision each particular room with sort of like, you know, your Wi-Fi, your internet connection, your telephone for particular tenants, et cetera, on a temporary basis. They'll also do all the access to the actual building. So for instance, if you want to give somebody access to a specific room or to specific lifts, they'll allow them to be able to do that. All the, you know, the passes to go in, and they're all digitized, all virtual, et cetera. So you get all that level of security. So that's one side of the of that whole provisioning, which is very, very quick, time efficient, saves a lot of effort and admin, and makes it much better quality service for the customers. And then the other side is actually managing the space within this sort of like, you know, short tenanted, multi-tenanted type of office. So you'd look at it, so like, is it a Regis, you know, something like a Regis or WeWork? They don't use them, because they use their own software. But to allow effectively those landlords to be able to rent out those rooms, that space, on a flexible basis, with you know, refreshments and everything to do with it, and then the whole selling process, the marketing, the CRM, the debt collection. So it's really an end-to-end digital platform of all things commercial real estate for largely for offices. And why is that interesting? Well, given the hybrid work now, what's actually happening is that not only you do get your flexible, your natural flexible landlords, your likes of WeWork and Regis, who see that there's more employers who want short-term lets, but equally the vast majority of the actual office buildings around the world are on long-term lets. So your likes of HSBC, you know, Google, Apple, people like that, and they have massive complexes on 10, 15-year leases. Well, they don't need that office footprint anymore. So either they will want to sublet that, or alternative, they'll give up those that large footprint they have. They'll reduce it, which will give the landlord, the normal commercial landlord who used to have long-term lets, he will then move that into more flexible to get it actually rented out. And so it falls perfectly into their path. So you've got this sort of like market shift from a far more sort of like long-term secure lets to more flexible. And flexible currently is less than 5% of the market. And it should go to about, over the next 10 years, to about 30%. And we're already seeing that. Anyway, the shares were listed or IPO'd at about £1.50 in 2019. They raised 33 million quid about a year ago at £2.85. The shares are currently 60p, and they trade on about 1x sales. Growing sales organically, it's difficult to say, but the market, the brokers are saying 30% this year. It will be unprofitable, but they were profitable pre-COVID. But what they're doing is that the money they invested last year, they're investing in growth in their product and their technology and the sales and marketing around the world. And that's what's making them unprofitable. But they know how to be, they're not levers they need to pull to become profitable, because they were that on a smaller sales footprint before. So they can do that and they can generate cash. But at the moment, it's sort of like this land grab, and they want to become the sort of the de facto standard for all things, digital office for flexible, large-scale landlords. And I think they've got a good shot at doing that. And they've got a very interesting shareholder register as well. They've got like Schroders on there, Amati, and a kind of Lion Trust, and they've got some other, you know, other good guys. The CEO, I think, still owns about 30% of it, Mark Furness. And I haven't spoken to him, haven't had a chance to sort of touch base, but I've put my Aviva money into Ascensus, because I say on 1x sales. The key is the sort of the key risks, in my view, is what is the office market going to be like going forward? Mm-hmm. And I think if you believe that more people are going to do from work from home and flexible offices, then this one will be an absolute winner, no doubt about it. But you've got to get your head right. Is that going to shift? And the second one is the landlords prepared to invest in new technology to get a better productivity, efficiency, and better servicing for their clients? And there is an argument to say, if we're going through a really tough time for all things offices, then they're not going to spend on anything, never mind on anything digital, even if it's going to improve their efficiency. But we are. But they just said on the last trading update last week, they are now start seeing that more flexible tenanted landlords are actually opening their purse strings, and the old classic traditional commercial office manufacturers, landlords, they are also starting to get interested. So coming back to that second question, no, it does look as though they want to spend because they're going to become, you know, more environmental, more efficient, lower cost base. They want a better service for their clients and all that kind of stuff. And then the third and final question that investors need to put the hat on is, is that 30% increase in the top line growth for this year, is it achievable? Now, I've worked that one through, and I believe it is. If you look at the first half, second half run rate from last year, there was sequential growth of about 12%. And I think they did, if I remember rightly, about 12.4% revenue in the second half of last year. So if you just doubled that, you get to 25, and they're looking for about 30. So they need an extra 5. They've added 1.6 just recently from their ARR. So that will be added onto it. So that's sort of 26.5. They're going to get a tailwind on the currency because over 50% of the revenues come from the US. So that'll be another 5% at 1.2. So you already get to like 27.5 before you've even started. And they should be able to do 10%, or if you just put in 7% like-for-like growth, then that takes you to 30. So it looks a big steep to 30% when you look at it year on year. But there's actually a way of actually reconciling that. And that's how I've gone through it on detail. So I'm comfortable with it. But the caveat that I haven't actually spoken to the CEO, Mark Furniss, when I obviously want to do that.
These came onto my radar back in March. It fell off a cliff, didn't it?
You didn't mention it.
I didn't do a lot of serious research on it, but if just because it fell off a cliff, and I tend to look at companies that rise a lot or fall a lot. And the funny thing was, I was looking at the market cap, and obviously the number of shares and issue was incorrect on the platform I was looking at. I thought, they've got like 30 million in cash. They valued it. It was something like something ridiculous, like about 10 million. I thought, I can't, what's going on here? The trading update wasn't that bad. I thought, what's going on? But the update is, so what about 38 million market cap? Are they? And then is that right? They're about 20.
Basically, they've got 60p is the share price, of which they've got more than 35p of cash. But a lot of that is going to be, they are burning cash. I mean, that's the other thing. They are burning about. Probably at the moment, the last year, they were burning about $1 million a month, which is quite a lot. But that will reduce, and they can reduce it because they've done it in the past. In terms of, it just means it's going to crimp some of their growth going forwards. But they certainly know how to do that, and I don't think their funding or their cash position is any problem. In fact, coming back to the Cake Box thing, that's where the strong get stronger, because this is a great opportunity where the market is shifting and they're going to be one of the few operators who have sufficient amount of money to invest in the product and to sales and marketing, and they will get better and they will gain more market share faster than anybody else because they haven't got to worry about their actual cash. So I think this is the right strategy.
When did you buy these? I'm looking at the volume, because there's not a lot of volume in this stock, is there? So when did you buy these? Because you got some deep pockets.
Just look how much volume there has been, mate. Just over the last 2 weeks, there has been unbelievable volume, and that isn't me. Somebody's been picking up some big pieces of that.
How long have you been in this? When did you get into these? Was it last?
As soon as the Aviva deal was announced. I think I bought my last lot, the last part on Tuesday, I think it was. Okay. So I couldn't get it all in one day. But I started last week, last week, and then I finished, I think it was on Tuesday. So I've got all I did was just lift and shift the proceeds I got from Aviva into Ascensus, and it's currently a 4.7% position in my portfolio. So, we'll wait and see. I mean, don't get me wrong, I don't want to pull the false sort of like, you know, give people a false message. This is, it's like all of my, you know, small cap stocks, technology. It's higher risk, but the valuation is, to me, is so compelling and the opportunity is so compelling that I'm prepared to hold, you know, to basically trade through short-term volatility. But this is a long-duration asset. It isn't going to generate cash or profits for at least 18 months, assuming that the top line continues to grow. And then it will do really, really well because it'll essentially take out its it'll take out the investment and all that extra money. Because it's the ARR, effectively the retention rate to 90% plus. The recurring revenue streams is 90% plus. So it's all locked in. And it's a great service for clients. So, you know, it's moving well.
Yeah. I've had no news on my stocks pretty much, apart from, like I said, it's just saw one on Truefin. Gfinity, which is quite good. This is the third leg of their... I mean, Gfinity have three sections to their business. And when John Clark came on board a while back, he said this. He said, we're going to build out the owner-operated websites we have. So we're targeting sort of, you know, advertising there. They already had supplying esports services to big brands. Not a lot of margin in there. They've cut back on that unless it makes sense for them. But what they were using, the technology they're using for these big brands, they're now spinning out as a software as a service. And they've done this. It's called Athlos. And this is what I like about this, is that recurring revenue, because a lot of these companies, you know, use technology and was previously packaged in with a service element. But they've been using it with these big brands for a long time, beta testing it. And in fact, I didn't realize how big it was. The gaming services sector is worth $127 billion a year. And they say it deepens player engagement, a lower player churn, increases average revenue per user. And the product has been used 73 million times in the last 30 days. But this is the company currently owns 100% of it. I think they'll spin some out. They're getting an investor on board. They said they've also... So I just say, if you look at the metrics on this, and this is what I quite like, and this is why I like this Gfinity above other sort of esports microcaps, is because now they have three areas. They've got good revenue on there, growing very quickly on their digital media sites. They've also got the esports services. But this final leg now, the recurring revenue services software, could be very big for them. And of course, it's recurring. And it's this in-game live service revenue is a key focus of the industry. It amounts to $127 billion and more than double the value of upfront sales revenue. Engaged competitive gamers can spend 30 times more in-game compared to the non-competitive gamer. So increasing engagement. And so basically, they supply this as a white label to many companies. It's largely automated. But it's got everything from, you know, chat areas to scoring, all this. So it's very engaged. So I quite like that. And they'll spin that out over the next, in fact, it's launching this quarter.
That sounds really good.
They've been sold off massively. It's like, you know, they've raised like 2.7 million back in, they've forecast to be profitable this year. They raised 2.7 million plus, again, double that with warrants. So they've got enough money now to take to profitability and beyond. But I think they're valued at 15 million. They've got about 3, 4 million in cash and can be profitable. And I think it's one of these areas that very high, you know, it will shoot up in bull markets, but again, it'll tank in bear markets. And it has tanked. It's just having a bit of patience to wait for it to come round, you know. Cool. Anything else, Paulie?
No, well, I mean, I think just watch out for investors. The next month is going to be absolutely red hot, isn't it, with small caps. So starting for me next week, I've got Equals, which is my biggest position. So I'm holding that one with a bit of breath. But it's done well, but I still think the trajectory is up on that one. You've got Source Bio coming out as well, I think, with you've got the Lords Group Trading as well coming out. So that's just next week, and then there's plenty. Everything is happening. I mean, my next biggest position I've got is Crestchip coming out with results, I think, towards the end of the month, third or fourth week, etc. And I just coming back to your bigger point on if we do see if energy becomes more elevated, say because there's rationing of electricity and gas, or particularly electricity in Germany or in Northern Europe this winter, then these guys, Crestchik, will absolutely just go to the moon because there'll be huge demand for backup power supplies, testing, servicing, and that's what you need a load bank for. And there'll be massive, you know, installation of diesel generators and all that kind of stuff, which will just play perfectly to Krestchik. So I do have a bit of a hedge, but I don't have energy other than that in my portfolio. So,
I think everyone should try and get, it's good to have a balanced portfolio, but also lean towards now companies you think, and if you focus on what companies are likely to do better than expectations of the next 12 months, which companies go below or meet, because I think if you're in the energy sector like that, addressing those kind of issues, like I said, that's why I got into e-energy, because they are, I don't know if it's a Grant Shapps today saying schools should go on LED lighting, and then e-energy replied saying, we do this with no capital upfront cost to the customer whatsoever. They reduced, I think it's Bellevue Education Trust energy by 62%, and they're doing this constantly. And I think, I can't see this company getting quieter over the next 12 months,
I'll tell you what, another good data point. This is just anecdotal. When you talked about sort of energy and power and stuff, there is already demand destruction going off. People who don't need to basically cut back on their energy consumption are doing, I'm just dittoing it, myself, my wife, okay?
Yeah.
I mean, the kids aren't with us anymore, so we don't spend shed loads on sort of like shit heating the house. But it's almost like a challenge.
Yeah,
we're gonna not put the heating on at least until the start of November, just for the next 2 months, and just see how we get on. To see whether we can keep the bill underneath. Yeah.
We did that. We got bills come in. They get lower than less last year. And my wife screenshots it on WhatsApp. Say, hey, we've beaten last year. But also, I'm going to send you a link. Right? It sounds odd, but a friend of mine, Paddy, on the weekend podcast, sent me a link to this electric blanket, and it's very cheap to run. He says it's ridiculous. He did the entire house. When all you want is to keep yourself warm, you're in one room pretty much most of the time.
Just chuck
that on and don't put heating on in the house.
Walk around with a battery and the other sort of like last tip, for people in terms of all things stock picking and energy related, is that my wife every week is going to be read the gas meter and the electricity meter. Okay, now. What we're also going to do, and this is the investment tip, is we're going to put in a smart meter. There is going to be an enormous number of people who are going to put smart meters in there. And if you're in that space in a company that supplies that digitization technology of power being supplied into houses and domestic properties, and to improve that whole area, you'll do really, really well. For stocks with smart meters and stuff.
I don't want to keep pumping this, because they own, but my energy, e-energy own MyZero, which is behind the circuit sort of energy, really granular data breakdown for companies. They only target companies spending $250,000 on energy a year or more. But they said, just through behavior, when people see where they're using energy, it cuts it by up to 30% just by behavior.
Yes.
And then they can do other things like LED lighting, on-site generation. But even by behavior alone, you can cut it down by 30%, because some companies, big companies, don't know where the energy is going. We don't know where they're using it. Sometimes it's overnight in a certain factory somewhere, and they put these in. So that's where you're using energy. Get rid of that, or whatever. Yes, it's amazing. Marvelous stuff. Cheers, Paul.
I'm going to go out and buy 6 blankets then.
Yeah, but don't go overboard, because you're pretty. You back up. So speaking in a few weeks' time.
Bye-bye. The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.